says, when you see Brown, that's time to talk. This is an interview with John Samsa for the Youngstown State University Oral History Program by Doug Sulhanic at Mr. Samsa's home on Thursday, April 18th, 1985 at 7:30 p.m. Okay. Tell us something about your parents and family and what you remember most.
As far as my family was concerned, my parents were immigrant people from Austria, as it were, and I can't exactly remember the year they arrived here, but when they did arrive, they had no knowledge of the English language. The language that was spoken was Croatian, and they were dependent upon people within the Bessemer area in order to do their, shall we say, translating for them. So they settled in the Bessemer area, and I, the youngest of the family group, I have two older sisters and an older brother. So I, in turn, am the baby in the family, as it were. So from the standpoint of age, I was born in 1920. And from the standpoint of early years, we went through, shall we say, some very meaningful early years when we didn't have the problem of the Depression, as it were. However, we did run into the Depression area, and I find that that was one of the very meaningful times of my lifetime. We learned to really appreciate, shall we say, education, making for our own recreation, and doing a lot of reading as far as recreation was concerned. So the Depression, as far as we were concerned, very meaningful, but it was very worrisome as far as our parents were concerned as well. But we actually had a great time with the games that we made up. We didn't need, or we didn't have a need for money. Just good friendship, camaraderie, and a lot of reading.
What was a typical day like in the Depression in a small town?
Let's take a Monday, for example. During the school time of year, on a Monday, we would go to school. I think we began at 9 o'clock, and we'd go to school until 12, then would have 1 hour off for lunch. During that 1 hour for lunch, we would go home to eat, and this is where we had the development of friendships, close friendships with people within the neighborhood, walking, running home, whatever the situation was. We had the hour off, we'd come back, and school would continue until 4 o'clock. 4 o'clock dismissal, once again. If it were a Monday, if we had sports, naturally they would take place after school. We would participate in sports. After the sports practice time, we'd go home and eat. And after supper, Monday night was library night. And the guys would get together, and we'd walk up to the library, once again, camaraderie. Going into the library, selecting our books, doing it in an orderly fashion, finding our books, and then once again, returning home, once again, camaraderie on the way home, and then it would be time to, well, do a little bit of reading. And as far as any homework was concerned, I planned my time quite well, wherein I had study time available at school, and so most of my work was done in school, and so consequently I had a lot of time for recreational reading at home. And so the recreational reading was at home, and then be off to bed.
Did your parents put any demands on you because of the depression? Any extra demands?
Not really. There may have been demands on my older brother, but as far as I was concerned personally, no. We worked in a garden. But that was part of living at that time anyhow. And just a lot of fun as far as I was concerned.
What would you do for a good time? What would you identify as a good time?
All right, good time, reading was really one of the very important recreational things as far as a good time was concerned. I can remember looking up friends within the community that would have, I can always remember this Baseball Joe series of books. I would borrow one particular book per week from this particular friend, reading the whole range of series, yeah. And to me that was great, great fun. But intermingled with that, we were very active from the standpoint of the sports program. Our total lifetime seemed to revolve around sports. We'd go from season to season. The baseball, the football, and once football was over, we did a lot of ice skating, playing hockey, and the basketball, of course. So it was good times for us was sports-oriented, very, very much so.
What do you remember about the small-town life before the war? What was it?
All right. Our town, before the war, the camaraderie, the fellowship, was tremendous. We would go down, we had two areas the younger people actually met. We had what we called Rick's Dairy in the evenings, and we also had the Isley store. And the young fellows would go down there and congregate and have perhaps a bar of candy and a bottle of pop. That was about the extent of it. And it was just intermingling as far as fellowship was concerned, and perhaps walking down down towards what we called the creamery at that time. It was about a mile walk. We'd walk down down toward the creamery, just conversation once again, and then walking back. Just plain, ordinary, good conversation.
How about the family activities?
As far as the family activity was concerned, I can always remember we had a game of lotto. It was very similar to bingo nowadays. That was one of the games that we had. We also had something on the order of pinball machines, but not the variety that we have nowadays. We could place it on the floor, and we played that that type of pinball machine. We played cards, and once again, intermingled with the games, good old conversation.
How about the getting closer to the war? When did you, what can you remember being the first sign of war or that you would be involved?
All right, very, very strong in my mind. On December the 7th, 1941, I was actually going to Cleveland, Ohio. And what I was doing at that particular time, I was driving our local automobile dealer, John Carlson was his name. He was picking an automobile up at the docks in Cleveland, and he was going to drive the new car back to Bessemer. And so I drove him up to Cleveland, then turned around. On my way back, I heard the announcement over the radio to the effect that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. So naturally, the excitement was very, very strong. And we had, at that particular time, a congregating point. It was at this automobile dealer's location, gasoline station. And we were almost, as young people, in a joyous mood and talking about, well, I guess we're going to have to go into the military and making, say, a 1, 2, 3, 4 and that particular type of marching command situation. And within our group, there must have been perhaps 10 or 15 talking about, well, we're all going to be getting into it. Of that particular group, I can remember right now off the top of my head, two of them were kidding around, having a great time that night, didn't make it back. They went into the service, into the military, and didn't return. So that was my introduction to World War II.
Okay, and from that point, how long did it take it before
you
went in?
I was actually inducted on August the 15th of 1942. We went, at that particular time, we went for our physicals up to Erie, Pennsylvania. We went by rail from Newcastle up to Erie, and that's when we were inducted into the service, into the Army in my particular case.
What were your feelings about leaving home?
As much as I was a small town boy, I'm very, very apprehensive. I never had really gone away for any extended period of time, so this was going to be a very new experience, very, very new for me.
A little different from that night at the car dealer.
Oh, much so. When the reality of the situation occurred where you're going to be leaving little old Bessemer and going to some, well, distant place, sobered you up quite a bit, yes.
What do you think the overall mood of the town was at the outbreak of war?
I think Bessemer was a great little town, and I think from the standpoint of patriotism, we were at the top. We had a great bunch of young people. As far as the older people were concerned, very civic-minded, united, and just a great place.
Was there some thought about fighting, that you might be fighting Germans before Pearl Harbor, and then maybe a different change of thought once Pearl Harbor hit?
As far as I can judge with the conversations that we had, no. The only thing was we were in, shall we say, a war situation, and whether they were German or Japanese really didn't matter.
Well, that gives the mood of the time, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, what about once you got into the service? Trace.
Okay. As far as my situation was concerned, I went into my basic training down in Fort Benning, Georgia. I was drafted into the service, but one of my skill areas, I had just concluded a machinist course, and there was an ordnance outfit that came through at the time in Newcastle and indicated if you had a skill, conceivably they would take anybody with the skill, and we could go into that ordnance battalion, as it were. So my start was to go into the 10th Armored Division in ordnance, and so the base at that time was Fort Benning, Georgia, and that's where I went for my infantry training, and took my basic at Fort Benning. Then while at Fort Benning, they offered certain people within that ordnance battalion the opportunity to go to communication school up in Fort Knox. And after I had my basic training, then I went up to Fort Knox. for, I think it was 12 weeks of communication training. It was on radio communication in particular. Then, while at Fort Knox, I had, just a matter of good, excellent timing in my particular case, they were looking for officers, as it were. And I received the opportunity to go to Fort Sill, Oklahoma for officer candidate training, which I accepted. Went to officer candidate school, and I received my commission as a second lieutenant on July 8th of 1943. Then following the commission, I went to flight school as a liaison pilot at Fort, as you were, not Fort Sill. I went to Pittsburgh, Kansas for flight training. And we were playing the flying the reconnaissance planes, little Piper Cubs. And I went to Pittsburgh, Kansas for preliminary flight training. After getting the preliminary work, then we returned to Fort Sill for specialized work with field artillery battalions. And I think it was sometime in December of that year, after concluding the training at Fort Sill, received orders to go overseas.
Was that all, would you say that was all meaningful training?
Excellent.
Was it?
I feel the training that we received in the Army was so efficient and well done. They more or less, in whatever work they taught, they almost used the block style of teaching. They would take one particular subject, concentrate on that for X number of days, conclude that, go into another specialized area. And to me, it worked very efficiently, and practically everything that we were taught was very meaningful.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, I can give you one good example. During flight training, this was in the advanced flight training, this was at Fort Sill. One of the maneuvers that we had to learn was, and this was up in the hills of Oklahoma, they had roads up there and curvy roads. And one of the things that we were taught was to make one-wheel landings on these curved roads so you could go ahead and land and actually make a curve with your landing rather than a straightaway landing. And we were oftentimes thinking, well, yeah, this is just a lot of useless work in one respect. But sure enough, there was the occasion in France where we were having difficulty finding landing strips. And one of the things that we had to do, we had this one very, very confined area. And the only way we could get into this confined area was to slip the ship down, the aircraft down, in a very sharp descent. That's one of the other things that we learned. Sharp descent, and then coordinate the movement of the plane so you land on one wheel and then converge and make the turn at the same time. So one of the very useless things that we thought we were getting in flight training turned out to be very, very meaningful in that situation, because I think in that particular landing, with the planes that were coming in, I think there are, maybe about three people washed their planes out, mm-hmm. trying to get into that confined area. But that, they seem to have covered everything with their training.
As you were going through that, did you ever get the feeling that you were being trained for something special, or was it just basic training that everybody was going through?
No, I thought it was very basic. In fact, when we got our orders to go report to Africa, we said, well, on ship, going toward Africa, we were talking about, well, we'll get some advanced training that will prepare us for actual combat. On the ship, we learned of the invasion of Anzio. And so that was just another part of the war as far as we were concerned. And we were actually talking about, well, where are we going to get advanced training? And somebody volunteered the information, there isn't going to be any more advanced training. From here on, we're going to be getting into the real thing. I personally felt, no, we weren't going to be doing that. But as it turned out, that announcement that there was a landing at Anzio eventually turned out that's where we actually went.
Okay, pick it up from there then. What was
Anzio.
That feeling? Well, even when you heard, what was that feeling like when you heard you were gonna?
All right, it was another military exercise as far as we were concerned. And when we got to Africa, we were located in an assembly area, and no one seemed to know where we were actually supposed to go, what we were supposed to be doing. We were just in a staging area there, and quite by accident, one of our pilots walking down the streets in Oran, that's O-R-A-N, Oran, I don't know what state now, met a fellow officer, and they got into conversation, and just by coincidence, that officer, we've been looking for you people. And very promptly, I think they got us orders, and I think within the day, within the next 24 hours, we were on our way to Algeria. From Algeria, we were lay over there for perhaps one night. Then from Algeria, we flew over into Naples. And from Naples, then eventually we got up to Anzio. So it was a very, very quick process once they found us.
Now, what wave were you in with? You weren't with the first wave at Anzio. It was the later, the backup?
Oh, as far as Anzio is concerned, it was a stalemate when we got there. And in fact, quite a meaningful experience. I have my logbook here. I'm trying to refresh myself. Flying up to Anzio, we had quite an experience. There was three or four planes. And what we had to do, we just had to fly on a compass heading to a certain distance. So because the German troops, of course, were occupying the land south of Anzio.
Okay.
And so we had to go out to sea and then back into land in order to make it safely. So we were challenged on our way up to Anzio by, it was a destroyer. They shot at us, indicating that we should shoot a colors of the day with a Very pistol. And so the head plane, or the lead plane, shot the colors of the day, but they didn't, evidently the destroyer personnel didn't see it. So they started to fire at us. And so it was a matter of maneuvers. Once again, something that we learned within our training, we got down close to the water and actually flew a zigzag course getting over to Anzio. So,
what was your mission?
At that particular time, all we were doing, we were getting to, I was going to the 3rd Infantry Division, to the air section, and the two other pilots that were going up, they were going to the 45th Division as pilots. And we were replacements. They needed pilots up there, and so that's what we were doing, going in to replace the pilots. And
and there would be new orders from there then.
Oh, yeah. See, It was a rather unique situation. They were looking for us in one way because they were short of pilots. And we had our orders, of course, and it was a matter of getting there so that we could get into our fire missions that we were in, the fire direction that we were concerned about. So we got there at Anzio, and I know I made two passes at the airstrip that I was to land at. And little did I know that the ground personnel there were angry due to the flat nature of Anzio. By making two passes at the airstrip would give the Germans an opportunity to possibly zero in on the airstrip. And I got in okay, and they told me right off the shot, no sooner I got in, how I had blundered as far as my approach was concerned. Mm-hmm. So that was one of my first learning situations. And in addition to the firing of the destroyer, or by the destroyer, at us, we no sooner got onto the airstrip than there was incoming artillery. And I said, what are we going to do now? Fortunately, of course, there were dugouts. And one of the pilots that was there at Anzio said, come on with me. And so the two of us went into his particular dugout. And the Germans at that particular time were making a move, trying to force the air personnel out of that particular location. And they'd moved a few tanks in and really putting us under a lot of pressure. And little did I know at that time what they were really trying to do. Some of the old hands there more or less indicated what was going on. As it turned out, that afternoon, the very afternoon that I got in to the airstrip, the tanks came in, tried to move us out. They were unsuccessful at that particular time. That evening, at night, we got orders to abandon the airstrip and then on foot go back to a new location. And that's what we did. The mud was deep, and my introduction to military combat was a very quick, mm-hmm. and almost breathtaking.
So you abandoned the planes and everything, or what?
We left the planes, and we were just of the opinion that, well, if the Germans took the airstrip, well, that would be a big loss. We'd have to have our planes replaced. But as it turned out, we went back to this new location. That morning, we returned to the strip. Everything was okay.
What were you flying?
The designation was L4H, just a Piper Cub. Just an observation plane.
Okay, and then after that, where did we go?
From Anzio. You know, let me go back. This is something that might be meaningful, and I oftentimes think of it. When I first got to Naples, we went to the landing strip where General Clark operated from. And in fact, I think the afternoon that I came in, General Clark, for some reason or other, was taking off, going somewhere, and he waved to us as we came in. I thought, boy, that was really great. Here's this young second lieutenant, there's General Clark. But either the night that we came to Naples, to that landing, to that airfield, we were invited. I think three of us, we as second lieutenants, were invited into this big meeting. And we were wondering, what is this? And here, one of the associate generals, an adjutant, I think, that was working with General Clark, called all of the officers in and just gave a free talk on the bombing that was going to take place on Montecino. And I said, man, boy, that's really something that they would give us that confidential information, the young second lieutenants. But I just thought that mm-hmm. as an aside was the type of situation we got into. I thought we ran into some great, great people.
Clark was in charge of the invasion then, or the early invasion, early operation.
He was in charge of the Fifth Army.
Okay.
Now see, then while we went to Anzio, our next objective was, of course, going to be Rome. And in our stalemate at Anzio, there was some bloody fighting that went on at that particular time. And very stressful, because we couldn't do much of anything. We were confined to that particular area, and the Germans on occasion would try to push us out, and there's some bloody fighting that went on. And in fact, we felt, when I say we who were flying, we felt we were safer up in the air flying than the ground personnel. But at any rate, at the particular time that we really made the push on Rome, I was hospitalized back in Naples. I had gone by hospital ship back to Naples, and I was confined to the hospital for maybe about a week, something like that. I developed pneumonia. And while I was there in Naples, the move was made on Rome. And so I joined our particular outfit once they got to Rome. Now, after we got to Rome, we were stationed there for a while. Then we got orders to go back to Naples and do some additional training. And our training down there was flying off of these aircraft carriers. They're makeshift aircraft carriers, small ones, and then we knew that there was something else was going to be coming up, coming off, which was the invasion of southern France, and that was going to be the next meaningful thing after Rome. We went back to Naples, staging area back in Naples, additional flight training, flying off of the aircraft carriers, and the one thing that I really missed was while we were getting ready to go in on our, when we were waiting to leave from Naples going to southern France, for some reason or other, I had to go down below deck. And during that time interval, when I had to report below deck, Churchill was making the rounds in the harbor, waving to all the various personnel that was ready to go on the invasion. I missed him. It was very distressing to me when I learned that was going to happen. But we left for the invasion of southern France, and our invasion of southern France was in the Marseille area, and we were expecting a really difficult time of it. And as it turned out, everything went quite well. I think we received but one round of artillery fire from the ground forces there. The aircraft came over, but they didn't actually do any bombing or spraying or anything. So our invasion of southern France was very successful. And one of the dominant things that I can remember was on our way up to southern France, we were prepped on the area that we were going to be going into. We had air photos of what we were going to encounter, and it was just everything went like clockwork. We knew, we saw what we were going to be getting into, As far as our aircraft was concerned, I had the good fortune of being the commander, flight commander, responsible for all of the aircraft taking off, and actually had control of the aircraft carrier for that period of time that we were flying, which was very meaningful to me as an individual. But we all got off. We had no accidents. We all got into our assembly area, landed, and then prisoners were being taken in almost immediately. And there was the stockade area where the prisoners were being assembled, and quite breathtaking as far as I was concerned.
You start getting a better feeling about
that. Oh, yeah. Oh, my, yes. Very successful at that time.
Okay, what about getting closer to the end? How far did you push, and
okay,
when did it end for you?
In southern France, we were just making, I think, gigantic strides. And we were going north, and I think it was in Montelimar, if I remember correctly, we encountered a tremendous force of Germans. And at that particular time, these forces were caught in movement on roads. I don't know where they were going. But I can remember flying in this particular instance and surveying all the damage that was done by the Allied forces to this particular group of Germans. But we destroyed so much equipment at that particular time. It was a tremendous amount of equipment. In fact, with the artillery pieces of the Germans, they were using animals at that time to pull that equipment. And so we felt things were going badly for them. It was starting to wear them down. They didn't have the necessary equipment, and it all looked very, very good for us at Montelimar at that particular time.
When was that then?
Pardon?
When was that? What time of?
Well, if I can find that.
Would that have been late in 44?
Well, I'll probably have the date here if I can get it. Let's see here. Well, are you going to get a blank on
no.
on your tape?
He says what? Tape's cheap, so just let
it. Oh. Yeah, try to find France here. Montelimar. August 29th, 1944. Yeah. That was the day. In fact, that was the very day that, in fact, I didn't have a flight mission. And our fire direction center called me up and said, the Germans are in trouble. Why don't you go on up, take a look? In fact, that was the tip-off. So I went up on a flight to survey the damage at that particular time. So we had a good feeling at that time that things were going our way.
Getting closer to the end.
Okay. We were progressing up toward actually German territory as such. Got up to Strasbourg, right at the Rhine River. And we came into this one, oh, it was a beautiful airfield. The Germans had to leave so quickly that they had wired the field just in case they had to leave so they could possibly blow things up. But we moved in so fast, they couldn't do any damage. And we were just alerted to the fact that whenever you land at this particular airstrip, just be very, very careful. Once you land, survey the area and make sure that you're very careful wherever you walk. Inspect things closely. So we went into this airstrip, and everything was in good order. And this was an experience that very meaningful to me. There was a place of business, I think it was on the order of an inn, that was located very close to this airstrip. And we commandeered that particular home and business as a sleeping quarters. We walked into the place, and this man came to greet us, and he spoke to us in English. And here, he had actually lived in the Pittsburgh area prior to the war for a period of time, then had gone back to Strasbourg and was going to live off of some of the money that he had made over here in the States. And of course, he was very, very cordial. And in fact, he's the one that indicated to us how he disliked Hitler. As a resident there on German holidays, whatever they were, they had to display the Nazi flag and a picture of Hitler in the window. That was absolutely a requirement, absolute law. And in fact, I asked him, I says, okay, I said, do you still have the Nazi flag? Yeah. And so we made an exchange there. He gave me the flag, and I have that as, shall we say, so-called souvenir, plus the picture that he had to put in the window of Hitler. So I brought it back home. I guess I have it somewhere. But at Strasbourg, on some of our flight missions, we were looking across the Rhine River, and we could see the Germans over there in this one factory area. It was quite a distance. I know they were doing work with the with their locomotives. They were switching railroad cars and so on. We didn't have the artillery fire to reach them, and we didn't call in any aircraft at that particular time. But it looked so simple at that particular time that I felt that we just could have gone across the Rhine and made our push and really moved them. As it turned out, we were at Strasbourg, and then our particular air section and our field artillery battalion, we were ordered to go down into the Colmar Pocket, down in southern southerly direction. Mm-hmm. They needed, when I say they, the French were in need of some help down there. So we went on detached service, just this particular regimental team, our battalion of artillery, plus our air section. We went down in the Colmar Pocket, and we were doing some fighting down there. In the meantime, the Battle of the Bulge developed up north. So we were actually in the Colmar Pocket at the time of the Battle of the Bulge. And what happened to me, which will more or less sum things up from the standpoint of the combat situation, while down in the Colmar Pocket, I had it wasn't an accident. It actually turned out to be my last flight. But I was up above these mountains, about 4,000 or 5,000 feet, and all of a sudden my propeller stopped up there. And I had to make a forced landing in no man's land. I had an observer, of course, with me, and we landed in no man's land. Fortunately, it was smooth enough. We were able to effect a good landing. I had my observer go out. We didn't have any self-starters. You had to go out and spin the prop. Mm-hmm. We spun the prop, it caught fire, and then hurriedly we flew out of there. Fortunately, we didn't get hit. And Following that particular landing, I was, all the pilots were asked to go for periodical checks. And at that particular time after that flight, they felt that I needed a rest. Mm-hmm. And that's when I went back down to Marseille, eventually went into a hospital situation there, recuperation from, shall we say, anxiety and stress and all, and then returned to the States.
So it wound down from there, but it was...
Yeah, but you could see it was going, it was on the way, oh yes.
When you were in, like in Rome, and then going through Germany and France,
mm-hmm.
Is there things that you can remember as enjoying, almost from not from a tourist standpoint,
oh.
But from stopping the...
The thing that I enjoyed, and I don't know on how many occasions, we were living in a private home that had been commandeered with an Italian family, very nice people. And it wasn't too far out of the city of Rome itself, but on occasion, we would go into Rome, and of course we would go to St. Peter's. And I went into St. Peter's, oh, I don't know how many times, and it was such a pleasure to be able to go in there and just walk around and see the all the cultural paintings and all, and the buildings themselves in St. Peter's Square area. It's so meaningful. And we'd be passing the Colosseum whenever we would be going in. And I often remark when we see it on television now, there's the Colosseum, and I think, oh, I used to travel in that particular area. And the same thing with St. Peter's.
How about home? What did you miss from home the most?
Naturally, parents and family.
What do you remember most about missing from home?
Parents and family. I know from the standpoint of my mother in particular, she was a real worrier. And of course she knew that I was in a combat situation, and it worried her tremendously. But the letters would come very regularly. And I try to correspond in a regular fashion myself. But the one thing that stands out in my mind was the fact that they sent me, of all things, and how it ever got to me, I'll never know, they sent me a salami, hard salami, and it got to me. Why it wasn't intercepted, I'll never know. But I think I was... can't recall whether it was in Italy or southern France. I think it was in southern France when it got to me. But they were always, when I say they didn't send too many things to me from the standpoint of edible things. It's just a matter of the regular letters and then I turned
to newspapers or anything? Do you remember?
No. Just the mail.
How about, did the community do anything for the servicemen in terms of any kind of care packages or anything like
See,
that?
I didn't, they did things, but I can't remember that I received any of those particular projects that they were working on. I know some of the other people commented that they had received certain things from home, but I can't recall that I did.
Okay, what about coming home? What was your route and what was the feeling like coming home?
Okay, coming home, as I indicated before, I was hospitalized in Marseille and I went on a hospital ship. In fact, I think it was called the Blanche F. Sigmund, named after a nurse, as a mm-hmm. hospital ship. And we left from Marseille and we were going on the southerly route, and it was going to take us, it was a converted Liberty ship, incidentally. And what they had told us that it would take us approximately 2 to 3 weeks to get home by the route that we were going, which seemed going to seem like an eternity. But on our way home, we heard VE Day, which was so...
like medicine.
Yes, indeed. The route that we were taking, the seas were calm, sunny, and so pleasant, you know, from the standpoint of the route that we were following. One of the, shall we say, if I use the word bad, distressing things that that I encountered there on the way home was this one friendship that I developed. This army captain who was a engineer, and he worked primarily with the railroads. And what he did, I don't know where it was in France, that he was actually working on this particular railroad, and he struck a mine, or stepped on a mine. It blew one of his legs off, and then when he fell on the other leg and struck another mine and blew the other leg off. But his attitude was one of just a great attitude. Didn't seem to bother him that much. But very distressing to me as an individual. But developed some very warm friendships at that particular time. But VE Day on the way home, of course, medicine. And then we got to our port of entry. That was Charleston, South Carolina. Then, from Charleston, I was sent to Wakeman General Hospital, Camp Atterbury in Indiana. And that's eventually where I was separated from the service.
How about coming back to Bessemer? What was the mood of the town that you can remember?
I was fortunate in that the particular time that I came home, friend Bill Palto was home on leave at the same time, and the two of us in particular got together from the standpoint of, shall we say, recreational activities, golfing and whatnot. But the mood of the town, once again, Bessemer was always great at, during those early formative war years. The people so warm and friendly and wanting to do practically anything that they possibly could to make your stay at home comfortable, recreational, and do practically anything for you. Just a great, great town. I always felt that Bessemer was, you know, one of the warmest places that a person could ever live in. Just a great place. And so the 30 days that Bill and I experienced together, were, we refer to them as the golden 30 days. Really great.
How about the Depression, now that the Depression's over after the war? Did you notice that? And once you got home and got settled, did you notice the town, was it booming or was it better than?
Oh, yeah. You know, from the standpoint, the Depression was actually, that was history. That was behind us. And everybody had, shall we say, a very bright outlook and going on to bigger and better things. And I think at that particular time, our town leaders Archie Schaub was the chief of police. Carl Montgomery was the mayor, and they seemed to be like a nucleus for civic activity. They were getting things going as far as community action was concerned, and they did so much for our town. Two of the great people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there anything important that we may have left out? Is there anything you can think of?
No. The only, in as much as you're taking a graduate course, I like to look upon World War II, and this may sound strange in one respect. I look upon World War II as one of the very most meaningful times of my life for this reason. From the standpoint of training, it was excellent. From the standpoint of unity, unification, it was there. We all had that goal wherein we had an enemy to defeat and we were going to do it. And I think I'm one of the very, very fortunate individuals that came in contact with all good people. And they were working toward that end. And it turned out to be a very efficient time operation. Everybody was working toward that common goal. There is none of this backstabbing that we encountered once we got back into the civilian life as such, where somebody's trying to hold you back if you're advancing or progressing. Very, very meaningful. And that's that was one of the main things that I experienced. We all worked together. I met great, wonderful people. And the thing that I, as an individual, found out I had only a high school education up until that particular during the war, and the thing that I found out was I most certainly wanted to get that baccalaureate degree. That was uppermost in my mind because of the I was fortunate in encountering a group of people, almost all of them were college graduates as such, and made me feel very, very insecure with my limited training. That was the one thing I wanted, education. And fortunately, after the war, with the GI Bill, I was fortunate enough to be able to go through school on the GI Bill. Another very, very meaningful thing as far as World War II was concerned.
So you think the Depression followed by the war, that was all good
training? Oh, absolutely.
Preparing for just about anything?
Oh, my, yes. I think that our particular generation was very fortunate in one respect, a very, very meaningful lifetime from the standpoint we were a fairly, what word I want to use prior to the Depression, it was a very worthy living situation prior to the Depression. Then we had the Depression, and we went through that in fine style. Then we went into World War II, and with World War II, with the unification, the training, and going, well, it was an adventure in one respect, going into World War II, especially in a combat situation where they're shooting at you, and you know you're on a day-by-day basis. We all lived in that fashion, too. We didn't know whether we would be back the next day, and so we made the most of each particular day. The camaraderie was great. Every night it was a group of us would be getting together, talking, and I can remember some of the people. I can remember one lawyer in particular that was within our group. He came from New York. And one was from New York. There's another individual, I think he was a farmer from in the South Carolina area. And this interaction, interchange of conversation with these people, it was an education in itself. Just great people. So we were fortunate.
Good. That's good.